parsha Vayetze deals with Yaakov Avinu's life after he leaves his family, really running away from the wrath of his brother. The parsha begins with a famous vision that Yaakov Avinu has, wherein he sees a ladder whose bottom is on earth and whose top reaches into the heavens, with angels ascending and descending the ladder. And the promise of Kadosh Baruch Hu makes to Yaakov Avinu that he will be with him and he will multiply his family. Yaakov Avinu then goes to Haran, wherein he meets the family of Lavan and arranges as a deal to work for the marriage, for the hand of Rachel, for 7 years. And on the wedding night, Leah, is the older daughter, is put in her place. And 7 days later, after the week of Sheva Brachot, Yaakov Avinu indeed marries Rachel, but agrees to work for her for another 7 years. And ultimately, Yaakov Avinu works another 6 years after that, for a total of 20 years in the house of Lavan. And the Torah really, in this parsha, deals with two aspects of Yaakov Avinu's sojourn in Haran. One is as a family man, building the Shifteikah. 12 out of his 13 children, including Dina, are born in this parsha. As well as another level of Yaakov Avinu's life, more of the business aspect, how he succeeds and really is prosperous as a shepherd and accumulates a tremendous amount of wealth using a tremendous amount of divine guidance and wisdom. I'd like to raise two issues, one a more general one, one more specific, on the parsha. The first more general one is we know that all the aspects that are found in the Torah are here to teach us a lesson. And the first question is, why do we need to know so much detail about Yaakov's life in Haran? We've spoken about in the past of the concept of Ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim, that which happened to our forefathers is a sign for their children. What is it that we are supposed to learn for our lives? What are the signposts that are found in this parsha which really guide Jewish history in the future? And the second more specific question is to try to understand a rather lengthy story at the end of our parsha, which seems also to be seemingly really irrelevant, or the details irrelevant. If we take a look at source number one, just a synopsis of the 31st chapter from verse 4 to the 32nd chapter, verse 2, and it was reported to Laban on the third day that Yaakov had fled, and he took his kinsmen with him and pursued after him a 7 day journey, and they overtook him at Mount Gilat. So finally, Yaakov sees that Laban's face is not the way it looked until now, and Yaakov decides to pack up and leave. And when Laban hears that he packed up and left, he chased after him. And Yaakov's angry and strove with Laban, and he said, "What is my crime? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? 20 years I've been in your employ, and the day drought consumed me, and the frost at night, and my sleep departed from my eyes." And Laban said, "Come, let's make a covenant, I and you." And they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there upon the heap. And Laban said to Yaakov, "This heap be a witness, and this monument be a witness, that I will not cross this heap to you, and you will not cross this heap in monument to me for harm." And they spent the night on the hill, and then Laban went his way, and Yaakov went his way. We know that the name of the place where this monument was established, what we call a non-aggression pact, was given two different names. And this is our second question. Why do we need all the details of this story in general? It's a very lengthy story about how Laban pursues him, and how Yaakov tells him a whole story about how honest he was and how difficult it was to be with Laban. But when we come to the naming of this treaty, of this place, so we find that the Torah tells us that when they built up the stones and to a monument, so Yaakov called this place Gal-Eid, revelation of the witness, of the sign. And Laban called the place Yigar Sahaduta, which is Aramaic for Gal-Eid, as the place of the monument, that these stones represent the monument. More specific aspect of our second question is, what is significance in the fact that Laban called it one name Yigar Sahaduta, and Yaakov called it another name Gal-Eid? The Torah, which again is so careful about words, what is it trying to teach us? What are we supposed to learn from this? In general, the view of our rabbis of Parsha Vayetze is really the Parsha which is a paradigm for the Jew in Galus. The Parsha begins with Yaakov Avinu leaving Israel, And the parasha ends with Yaakov Avinu coming back to Israel when he sees an encampment of angels and calls it Machanayim. And the bulk of the parasha is Yaakov Avinu in exile and the trials and tribulations that occur to a Jew in exile. And that's why, as Rav Chaim Shmulevitz points out in Sichos Musar in Source 3, he says that when you examine the parasha of Vayetze, you'll notice that it does not contain any p'tuchot or sumot, blank spaces between sections which serve to denote the end of a topic, and whose purpose is leitbonen ben parasha leparasha, to allow contemplation between sections about what one previously learned. If one looks at a printed text, one notices very often there's either a samech or a pei at the end of a section, or within a Sefer Torah proper, there's either a nine-line space or beginning the next paragraph, wherein the Torah allows for pause, allows for contemplation, to review what was learned before continuing onward. It's interesting to note that Parsha Vayetze does not have one Parsha Psucha, one Parsha Stuma. There's no pause, there's no break. And the reason for that, as Rav Chaim Shmulevitz points out, is what we've spoken about, that Parsha Vayetze is the Parsha of Golos. It's the Parsha dealing with the exile of Jew. And when you deal with an exile of the Jew, there's no room to stop for contemplation. As he says, continuing in Source 5, because it is the beginning of the history of the children of Israel, and as such one should not and may not contemplate any part of Israel's history separately. Israel's history, of which Vayetze is the beginning, can be understood only as a whole, not each event by itself. And this really is the answer that Eov was given, that Job was given. When Eov asks, "Who shall tell me that I should find him and present my case before him?" Hashem Baruch Hu answered, "Where were you when I established the earth?" At the time of creation, the entire tapestry of history had already been woven. As it says, he showed Adam each generation and its leaders. Explained to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, one who attempts to understand history frame by frame is doomed to failure. It is only by placing events in the universal context that one can truly perceive God's handiwork. This is the key of understanding the Jew in exile. You have to see things in terms of perspective on a larger spectrum rather than trying to understand piece by piece, which in its own right makes very little sense. And indeed, this is a directive for an individual in one's own life as well. We know the famous personality, Nachum Ish Gamzu, who always used to say, "Gamzu L'tova, this too is for the good." Explains Rav Chaim Shmulevitz that the responses that he had to events that occurred to him was not merely demonstration of simple faith, but rather perspective events in the overall context. While each event in its own was bad, this too would add up to a benevolent total, which in fact it did. He was able to view God's deeds with the approach of a very famous pasuk in Tehillim in the 19th chapter, verse 10, Mishpatei Hashem Emet, Tzadku Yachdav. God's judgments are true, they, his deeds, are righteous when taken all together. And this is the key in life. If you look at events separately, in their own small little context, oftentimes we don't understand why this happened or the reason for this happening. But if one has the ability to see things Yachdav, to see a perspective of overall over time and to see the larger picture, so then we understand that the Mishpatei Hashem are Emet, that the ways of God are true. So we therefore see the Parsha Vayetze is really the paradigm of the Jew in exile, and it's the model of being able to see things in perspective. What I'd like to try to examine together today is to see one experience of the Jewish people in Golos, and to see how this Parsha really parallels this experience, and how it's important to see the experience in its overall context without looking at the small details of the event. What I really like to try to do together is to try to understand the experience of Yaakov and Lavan's house, and in particular the chase of Lavan, on two different levels. We know that there are four levels to understand the Torah, what is commonly referred to as Pardes, the Pshat, the Remez, the Drash, and the Sod. I'd like to take a look this evening on both the level of remez, of hinting, as well as the level of drash, explication of the text. to understand it in the context of Jewish history, the context of Remes, it's interesting to note that many commentators see many different Jewish historical events in the experiences of Yaakov. Shem Shmuel talks at length about how it refers to the experience in Bavel. Others talk about the Golos of Yavan. I'd like to share from the Sefer Meirah Makim, based on the speeches, the talks of Rav Moshe Shapiro Shlita, how this experience parallels the Golos of Mitzrayim, the exile of Egypt. And he begins his remark by a very fascinating insight of the Gra, the Gaon Mivilna. And he says, Yaakov b'Lavan, dugmat Yisrael b'Mitzrayim. That which occurred to Yaakov in the house of Lavan is really parallel to Jewish people's experience in Egypt. And he says, for example, just like Yaakov left with a tremendous amount of wealth, so too Klal Yisrael left Egypt with a tremendous amount of wealth. And just like Yaakov used his staff in manipulating the sheep in order to make his wealth, likewise the staff, in this case Moshe Rabbeinu's stick, was instrumental in the Jewish people's ultimate redemption from the land of Egypt. And he notes further that Yaakov Avinu ran away for 3 days, and from the third day that Lavan was told, and it took him until the seventh day to catch up with Yaakov. Likewise, we know in Egypt that the third day Paro was told the Jewish people escaped, and it was only on the seventh day, what we refer to today as Shavi Yishal Pesach, that Kriyas Yamsuf happened, that the Egyptians finally overtook the Jews. And that's why it says the Gra so beautifully. V'lachein amru b'sipur yitziat Mitzrayim v'doresh marumi oved avi. That explains why in the Haggadah, when we're talking about the experience of the Jew in Egypt, so the Baal Haggadah begins to say, Lamad, if you want to know about the Egyptian experience, go out and learn what Lavan Harami Bikesh Laso, what he wanted to do. Why are we talking about Lavan suddenly in the middle of the Seder night? So explains the Quran in such a beautiful insight that if you want to understand the whole experience of the Jew in Egypt, so what you need to do is to study Yaakov and Lavan. If you understand the experience of Yaakov and Lavan, so then the experience of the Jew in Egypt makes perfect sense. Say Laman, go and learn it. So Moshe Shapiro explains on a deeper level, aside from all of these similarities between the story of Yaakov and the story of the Jews in Egypt, on a deeper level, what is the connection, the philosophical connection between these two events. So he notes that there are basically two major themes that connect the Yaakov experience and the Jew in Egypt experience. The first one is, as we know, in Source 9, our rabbis, Midrash Shochar Tov, likened the Jews in Egypt, l'ubar hanimsa b'meimo, like a little child who's found in his mother's womb. That the Egyptian experience was the experience of transition. We went from 70 avot, 70 original founders of the Jewish people, and they multiplied into 600,000 Jews. And this was the experience of the Yitzirat Ha'am, the formation of the people. Likewise, we have the same thing with Yaakov in Lavan's house. He comes as an av, he comes as a father, and he leaves the experience it was with many more children. This is, in both cases, it's a shlav ma'avar. It's a point of transition from the fathers to the sons. In both cases, it's really the development of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, one on a micro level and one on a macro level. But on the second level, Mamakim takes this even deeper. He says, did one ever wonder why the Jews were specifically put in Egypt for that to be their experience of exile? And it says the reason for that is very clear. The reason for that is because Egypt at that time represented the height of immorality, the height of toeva, of that which is an abomination in terms of their behavior. And the reason why the Jews were put specifically in this environment was because when you have two things that are so dislike, then each item really wants to maintain its own character so it remains with its properties without thinking to mix with the other property. So to take on a technical level, scientific level, you take oil and water and you put them together in a cup. So since oil and water are so different, the oil will rise to the top and the water will stay in the bottom. But if you would take two different types of oil together, say an olive oil and a corn oil, so then even though they're different oils and they have different properties to them, the chance and the likelihood that they'll intermingle and some oil will mix into each other is very probable. That's what will happen. The Jews were in Egypt because God wanted the Jewish people to maintain and to really evolve in their own standards and not to be caught up in the standards of the Egyptians. By putting them in a place so different from them, they were able to maintain who they were. And that explains the Medrash, that they didn't change their names, they didn't change their dress, they didn't change their language. They really maintained their identity of who they were. And he says where you really see the final climax of the Jews being able to maintain their identity was at the moment when they saw the Egyptians pursuing them. And explains that the reason why the Egyptians were pursuing them is that the Egyptians really wanted to bring the Jews back under their domain, to have the Jews really try to integrate their philosophy and their culture. When the pasuk says, "V'nei Mitzrayim noseach reihem," and behold, Egypt was running after them, was chasing after them. So the rabbis point out that noseach is written in the singular. It should be the Mitzrayim or noseim are chasing in plural. So rabbis explain in the Medrash that they saw the Sarosha Mitzrayim, the archangel of Egypt, running after them, which Rav Dessler explains to means, it means the archangel represents the culture, the values of that nation was chasing after them. At that moment, the Jewish people really made that final break and said, this is not for us. What they really wanted was to connect with God. It's the Vayaminu Ba'ashem U'B'Moshe Abdo. It's the Zeh Keli Vanveyu, the ability to point to God. And that's why, at the end of Kriyas Yamsuk, we have the Pasuk of Lo Tosifu L'Rotam Odad Olam, that God promises that they're not going to see the Egyptians ever again. The final break was made. The Egyptian experience, particularly with the Egyptian culture, was to allow the Jews to maintain their standards, not to intermingle with them, and to really emerge with their own identity and their own culture. This same experience is exactly what happened with Yaakov and Lavan. That the experience of Yaakov being specifically in Lavan's house was in order for Yaakov to really clarify and identify that which made him unique and special, and not to get caught up in the world of Lavan, the world of deception, the world of cheating. And Yaakov was able to maintain his ne'emanut, his trustworthiness, his emes, his word being his word. But not only was Yaakov Avinu successful in maintaining his standard, where he wasn't going to get caught up in Lavan. The same models we see in Egypt, where you're put against the diametrically opposite philosophy, and you're really forced to stand for what you believe in. Yaakov Avinu was not only successful for himself, but he was successful likewise for his children as well. And he succeeded in inculcating to the next generation to maintain that standard, to maintain that high level of the Beis Yaakov, the house of Yaakov. And one example we see this is later on when the brothers have a difficulty with Yosef. The pasuk says, Lo yachlo dabro l'shalom, they couldn't speak nicely to him. They weren't achab apev, achab alev, they weren't two-faced. They had the smid of emes. If they had problems, so they were going to tell you they had problems. This was something that they learned in the house of Yaakov, specifically in the environment of Lavan, and yet not learning from Lavan. The same example of Egypt, of being with Egyptians and not learning from them. So we see in both cases this overall experience that the Jews had to go through and that Yaakov had to go through. It wasn't just the experience of the difficult working conditions that Yaakov had or the difficult hard labor that the Jews had. It was the whole experience of being around an environment, going through tremendous difficulties, and ultimately coming out victorious and ultimately coming out stronger because of these events. What I'd like to do briefly is to take a little detour and see one example within our parsha of the success that Yaakov Avinu had in raising his children, in particular in the environment of Haran, and yet being so successful in Chinuch Habanim, in the teaching of his children. And that is in examining one of the most perplexing texts in the Chumash. It's so perplexing that the Gemara tells us that the wicked king Menashe went through the Chumash and noted all the irrelevant sections in Chumash. And this reached the top group of irrelevant sections. But when you learn it and understand it, you see it's far from irrelevant, but it had worlds and worlds of beauty and truth. Let's take a look at the section together in Source 18, Chapter 30, Perek Lamed, verses 14 to 18. Reuven went out in the days of the wheat harvest. He's at this time a four-year-old boy. He found Dudaim in the field. Some translate it as jasmine. Some people explain it as fertility. Plants, whatever it is, these beautiful flowers. And brought them to Leah, his mother. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's Dudaim." But she said to her, "Was your taking my husband insignificant, and now to take even my son's Dudaim?" Rachel said, "Therefore he shall lie with you tonight in return for your son's Dudaim." When Yaakov came from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, "It is to me that you must come, for I have clearly hired you with my son's Dudaim." So he lay with her that night. Guard hearkened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Yaakov a fifth son. And Leah declared, "God has granted me my reward because I gave my maidservant to my husband." So she named him Yisachar. And at the article Stone Chumash points out that this is one of the most puzzling sections in the Torah. He says, regarding other verses, it's axiomatic that human intelligence is capable of only a superficial understanding of God's word. Regarding the verses of Judaim, it is obvious beyond doubt that the episode is filled with the mysteries of the Torah. And many commentators try to understand this whole dialogue. What was the significance of the Judaim? What was Rachel's conversation with Leah? Why did she want the Judaim? Why was she willing to give up her husband so easily? How are we to understand this whole conversation? What makes the whole section even more bizarre, if we could say such a thing, is a Medrash on this section. The Medrash says, source 21, quoted by Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov in Sefer Parashios, "Zuhi Sida v'zuhi Sida. This one Rachel lost, and this one Leah also lost. Zuniskara v'zuniskara. This one gained, and that one gained." Well, let's understand, what did they lose, what did they gain? Leah hisida dudaim. Well, it's clear. Leah lost the dudaim, these flowers. V'niskara, what did she gain? Shnei shvatim, two more tribes, Yisachar and Zvulun, who was born right afterward. Ubechora, which means she had the majority of the children. Vikfura, and she was buried with Yaakov Avinu Maris Machpelah. The rabbi said her flippancy, Rachel Imenu's flippancy, if we can understand such a thing, on her level, of therefore we shall lie with you tonight, so that allowed Leah to be with him, and Rachel Imenu lost that opportunity. Continues the Medrash and says, "V'Rachel niskara judaim." Well, Rachel gained something. She gained the judaim, the flowers. V'Yisida shvatim v'Bechara kfura, and she lost out on having two tribes, the majority of the tribes, and being buried. And this, they explain, "Shakul hu harevach v'afseid shal shnehem, revach v'afseid lazeh v'revach v'afseid lazeh." And the rabbis comment that this was an equal dealing here. That this one gained and that one gained. This one lost and that one lost. Take a look at the statement of our rabbis and you're astounded. You say, this is a fair deal going on here? Rachel Imenu gained what? Flowers. What did she lose? Children. The majority of the children. A place to be buried. Leah Imenu, what did she lose? So she lost the flowers. What did she gain? Give out what she gained. And you're going to now tell me that this is an equal balance? This is an equal deal? Hayitachein? Is this possible? How are we to understand this whole story? So there's a beautiful, beautiful insight from the Sefer of Parashios by Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov that I first heard in a shiur by Rabbi Adlerstein many a year ago, that I think is worthwhile reading in its entirety inside. but shed so much light on the story of the Dudaim. Says Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov the following. He says, if we go back to history, the first man and woman, they were alone in the world. The entire world, or at that point, the entire garden was thirst. And God says, you know, you can eat from any tree that you want to eat. But one tree, this is not for you. And as he describes it, Vayahu to eats tov l'machal, it was good to eat, v'te'avah le'naim, and beautiful to the eyes, v'nechmad la'askil, chamdu lo upashtu yadam v'sheino shelahem, gezlo rishon ba'olam ha'adam kivyachol ad'elokav gazal. Says Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov, they couldn't resist. They ate from the tree. And by eating from the tree, they stole from God. And as he continues, this aspect of not being able to withstand the test and the concept of stealing from God and stealing from others became prevalent as the generations continued. As we've spoken about, that the door of the Mabul, of the flood, lo nechtam gzar dinam el ala gezel, their final decree was because of thievery, because of robbery. So we have the downhill slide, the domino effect from the time of Adam HaRishon. Throughout all those generations, no one's been able to correct this. Comes along a family who has a chut ha-mishulash shulolam lo yinatek, a three-strand cord, the Avos, the Avraham Avinu, the Yitzchak Avinu, and the Yaakov Avinu. They come to try to be metakein to fix the sin of Adam. Now here comes the key. What is the first byproduct of the three Avos? Who is the first one that comes out that is our trial to see whether they've been successful in the metakein and fixing the sin of Adam? Whether they've been successful within their own family in trying to raise people with their own identity? It's their oldest child, who in this case is Reuven. Reuven now is a four-year-old youngster, goes out to the field, as the Torah tells us, in the wheat harvest. There is plenty out there for this young child to take. And what draws the attention of this child? He doesn't go for the wheat, he doesn't go for all the crops. He goes for the Judaim, which we know are hefker, that are wild flowers, that belong really to anyone. No one cares if you take them. Here is a son, as the rabbis point out, we see from here that he wasn't involved in Gezer. Here is a child who has the whole world really not belonging to him except a certain number of flowers, and that is exactly what he takes. But it goes deeper than that. Once he finds these flowers, he doesn't say, beautiful flowers, beautiful fragrance, let me keep them for myself, let me enjoy them. Rather, what does he do? He says, I found these flowers and my mother didn't. And I owe so much to my mother. Let me go and bring them to my mother. As the pasuk says, and he brought them to Leah his mother. He brought all of them to Leah his mother. He kept nothing for himself. My friends, do you see the excitement in this event? This is a major turning point in Jewish history. A major turning point in world history. Here, at this moment, when this young boy takes these wild flowers and doesn't take any for himself but gives it to his mother, this is the point where we see the tikkun, the rectification of the sin of Adam. This is where you see the chinuch, the education that Yaakov Avinu imparted to his children, even in Lavan's house, despite being in Lavan's house, despite being in an environment of cheating, he's successful. And that's what Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov is the reason that Rachel Imenu wanted these Judaim. What she wanted more than anything else was to bring these flowers to Yaakov Avinu to make him happy, to show him the success of really the first space Yaakov system around. And Rachel Imenu, who was so selfless by giving over her sister, explained to Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov, she was also involved in the Chinuch Habani. Although she didn't have any biological children, all of the Shvatim, all of the tribes are really her children. When Yirmiyahu HaNavi describes Rachel's Mivakal Baneha, crying for her children, is it just for Yosef and Binyamin she's crying for? No. It's for Reuven, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvul, and all of her children.
all of the Shvatim are her children. This is the moment that we've been waiting for. And this is the moment that Rachel Imenu wants to share with her husband. Zu Niskara. Yes, she has gained a tremendous amount. It's interesting to note that this child that is born is called Yisachar. And as the Chatam Sofer points out in Source 26 and 27, we do not read it as Yisachar, as it's written, the two shins, but rather Yisachar, one of the shins. The Torah gives us the reason why he's called this name, referring back to the text where God has granted me my reward because I gave my husband. That's only one of the shins. The other one, which we keep out of sneers, we keep out of modesty, quiet, we don't read that, we don't pronounce it Yisachar, but rather Yisachar, is the Sachar, is the reward that she got for giving the Dudaim, giving these flowers to her sister, that she acquired her husband. But as the Chasam Sofer points out so beautifully, is that by mentioning in the text the reason of giving her maidservant, it really reflects on both reasons. Just like she gave her maidservant in order to multiply children, that Yaakov Avinu had more children. Because normally a woman doesn't encourage a rival in the household, and she's doing it l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven. So clearly here also, her going out and seeking her husband is clearly also to have children. And the biggest proof of that is the child, Yisachar, that's born, is the greatest one involved in learning Torah. Many people say it was Shavuot night that he was conceived. So clearly it was God's stamp of approval on her action. But it's interesting that Rabbi Eliyahu Kitov notes that there's a deeper way of understanding Yisachar's name and the silent sin. And then really the second shin is reserved for Rachel Imenu. In her state of weeping, so Kadosh Baruch Hu tells Yirmiyahu HaMelech, tell Rachel Imenu, ki yesh sachar lefulatech, there is a reward for your deeds. The yesh sachar lefulatech, what is the schar that we're talking about? It's the schar, it's the reward for the dudaim that she so wanted in order to share this wonderful news with her husband. So once again, it's an interesting detour where we see the success of Yaakov Avinu and his children in terms of maintaining a standard of not stealing. And we see this carried out throughout. So later on, when the brothers find the money in their sack, they were horrified. They returned the money. They were horrified that they would find the gaviyah in any one of theirs, the goblin in any one of the brothers' sacks. This is the level of how careful they were in this arena. Going back to the final point to bring together this Miramakim essay, is that just like the grand finale for the Jews was at Kriyas Yamsuf, when Mitzrayim and its whole culture was chasing after them, and they really turned wholeheartedly to God, the same thing happens on a micro level with Lavan and Yaakov, where Lavan chases after Yaakov, and he really chases after them to bring them back. And he says, Habanot benotai v'abanim banai v'atzon tzoni, v'chol she'ar taro elihu, children are my children, everything you see is mine. And Yaakov's response is, I understand that you feel that you want them under your tutelage and under your control, but we're moving on. We're separate and we're different. And here comes the beauty. Lavan calls this place Yigar Saaduta, an Aramaic name. Yes, he's saying, you think that you're separate, but I'm still going to include you in a national way, in a multilingual way, where you can still be part of us. We'll speak the same language. We'll have the same social interchange. To which Yaakov responds and says, no, the name is not Yigar Saaduta, the name is Galeid. We have our own identity. We have our own language that shows you the split that we're about to make now, like the split in Egypt, is going to be a final split. And as the Sforna points out, the next pasuk says, and Lavan declared this mound is a witness. Vayomer Lavan Hagal HaZa'id. He subordinated himself to Yaakov by agreeing to call it by the Hebrew name. He declared that it be a witness of what he was about to say. That even Lavan agrees to this. Rav Shapiro ends this essay by saying that this is the challenge that we have today living in Galus.
We need to take the model of Yaakov in Laban's house, the model of the Jew in Egypt, and to realize that when we are among the nations, that we have to maintain our identity and not to begin to assimilate. That we need to realize that sometimes when we live in such a debased society, that makes it all the more easier to really strengthen our values and stand firm in our values. And that's the challenge we have today. When you have, as the lead article in a Jewish paper, this Pokemon cards and movies and how it's really infiltrating the Jewish community, this is the challenge that we have. How do we keep the culture and so much really evil, perhaps evil is too strong a word, but the difficulties within the culture, how do we keep that away from what our standards are, from what makes us special and what makes us unique? This is the challenge. This is the model of Yaakov and Laban's house, to be able to raise a Reuven who's able to pick up the Judaim and give it to his mother as a gift. One final note before moving on to the second level of the Drash is a very interesting insight of the Or Gedaliah that explains why, in general, does the Jew need to be put into Galus. What was the point of God having Yaakov go to Laban's house, the Jews in Egypt, the Jews in Yavon, the Jews in Babel, whatever it may be? So explains the Or Gedaliah that the tafkid of Klal Yisrael is to pick up the nitzon shel kedusha, the sparks of holiness. That in every place there's a certain amount of either physical holiness or people who are tremendous sparks, and the Jews have to draw out these sparks, and that is why they are put in any place in Galus. And says Rav Gedaliah Shur, source 37 and 38, it's very fascinating to note that if you look at Jewish history, very often Jews will be in a place for a long, long time and then be expelled. And then we find that many times, very often, the Jews en masse do not return to that location. Take the Spanish Inquisition. With the golden age of Spain, the Jews lived there and flourished. And after the Inquisition, although you have pockets of Jews in Spain, you really don't have the community that once was. Why? It explains to Rav Gedaliah Shur that there were certain sparks in that country, that once the sparks have been taken out of that country, so it's time now to move on. Rabbi Tauber, in the Inside Story, based on the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe, explains what is his concept of sparks. He says in Source 41, where each and every creation, no matter how material and mundane, has at its heart a spark of holiness, a spark that embodies God's desire that exists and its function within his overall purpose for creation, a spark that is the original instrument of its creation and that remains nestled within it to continually supply it with being and vitality, a spark of holiness that constitutes its soul, its spiritual content and design. Entrenched in the physical reality, these holy sparks are virtual prisoners within their material encasements. The physical world, with its illusions and self-sufficiency and arbitrariness, suppresses all but the faintest glimmer of godliness and purposeness of being. And that's why we're here in this world. When we use something directly or indirectly to serve God, it penetrates its shell and reveals and realizes its divine essence and purpose. And that's why he says so clearly, why does a person like Yaakov Avinu, who spent most of his life in the tents of study, in pursuit of wisdom and closeness, leave the spiritual oasis and go to Haran? Reason is, and one reason only, he's hunting sparks. This is the first level of our story. It's Yaakov hunting the sparks in Laban's house. And that's how Rav Gedaliah Shur explains that the face of Laban was not like the face as it had been previously. Yaakov saw that the sparks had now been taken out. His face looked different. The experiences were different. It was time now to move on for another experience. The sparks that were needed were taken out. The experience of the Jew in exile is the experience of taking these sparks, of elevating the experiences into a godly experience. I'd like to very briefly note that this concept of redeeming the sparks
of the Jew in exile is really a paradigm for the individual within our own lives. And this we find in Source 43, continuing in Rabbi Talbert's Inside Story based on the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's really the story of life itself. The story of Jacob's journey to Haran, where he spent 20 years in the home and employ of the evil Laban, is the story of life itself. The soul too leaves behind a spiritual and godly existence to preoccupy itself with material needs, to become a shepherd and entrepreneur in the Harans of the world. The soul too must condescend to deal with the crassness, hostility, and deceptions of an alien employer. It must struggle to extract the sparks of holiness from their mundane husks to deliver the flocks of Laban into the domain of Yaakov. The most obvious way we do this is through mitzvot. We take wood and we build a sukkah. We take a coin, we give it to tzedakah. We take leather and we make tefillin, mezuzah. The other way of doing it is, as he notes in 46, the same is true of the more indirect ways in which we redeem the holy sparks buried in creation. For our sublimation of the material is now limited to our actual performance of mitzvot. Indeed, our every physical act can be directed to achieve this end when incorporated into one's service of the Almighty. For example, every time we eat, we can do so with the intention to serve the Almighty with energy derived from this food. The sparks of holiness contained within this food are thus redeemed and unified with their source, despite the fact that this act of eating did not constitute a mitzvah. In this and similar ways, every moment and resource of a person's life can be transformed into an act of deliverance and sublimation. And that indeed is how the Nesivot Shalom, the Summoner Rebbe, explains the model of the Sulam, of the ladder at the beginning of our parasha. Nesivot Shalom notes that the Medrash begins off when describing this section with the Pasuk from Tehillim in chapter 63, Samal Chanashi, Kamal Chabasari, Beretziah, Vayef Blimayim. How David HaMelech, who's in Midbar Yehudah in the desert of Judea, notes how much his heart yearns and thirsts for God. It's not only a question when you're sitting in God's temple, do you have this relationship with God? You can be so far away and have this relationship. It explains in Sivul Shalom, this is the key in life. The key in life is your tshuka, your desire. You may have your feet very well planted on the ground in the material world, but the Rosho Magia Shamaima, but the head of the ladder, the top of the ladder is in heaven. The Malchei Elokim, the angels are only in the Yerdimbo. They're on an upward path. If you have a tshuka, Samal Chanafshi, you have a desire to get close to God. So no matter what physical act you may be involved in, that desire elevates, redeems the sparks of that physical act and brings it up to and makes it into a godly act. And he notes, in other words, continuing Rabbi Tauber, there are two types of sparks that a person redeems in the course of his life. The first are those which he consciously pursues, having recognized the potential for sanctity and goodness in an object or event in his life. The second are those which pursue him, opportunities which he will never have realized on his own, as they represent potential so lofty that they cannot be identified and consciously developed by his humanly finite perception and faculties. And this second aspect is described in the end of our parsha, and that's why we have such detail about it. The bulk of our efforts are conscious and focused through the Haran, where goals are defined, opportunities recognized, endeavors planned and achieved. It's so much of our lives. With people around in the business world can tell you all the time how they meet Jews, how Jews are interested in that they're factored eating kosher. It brings out certain aspects of Judaism in them. They begin to talk. These are what we're talking about, opportunities in life for sparks to be redeemed. And they're all around us. Opportunities to meet people, opportunities to elevate an event, to say a kind word, to make an occasion, whether it's a party, a special occasion, or even an interchange, one person with another, to say something kind, to say a compliment, to say something beautiful. You're able to elevate that moment, to redeem the sparks of that moment. That's what we're here for. But then, there are the Mount Gilad experiences too. They're the accidents of life, situations we never desired, encounters which pursue us, even as we flee from them. These may aggravate and exasperate us, but we must never dismiss them and fail to extract the kernel of good that certainly lies buried within them. Indeed, they must contain the most elusive and most rewarding achievements of our lives. The story of love on pursuing Yaakov is the story of how in life there are times when we don't plan on certain events. And yet it is in those events too that we have the challenge of redeeming those sparks and coming closer to God. Very brief story is Rabbi Teller's first book, Chanoch Teller's first book, Once Upon a Soul. His first story opens with a beautiful story, which we'll just say very briefly because of time constraints, of a rabbi who's on a plane a couple days before Rosh Hashanah, supposed to land in Athens, and he'll switch in Athens to take a flight to Tel Aviv. And he falls asleep and misses getting off in Athens. And the next stop is Lebanon, and they make sure he hides and no one sees him. And then they ultimately land up in Bangkok. And here he is, Erev Rosh Hashanah, in a strange place, looks for the nearest Jewish community, lands up in basically a Reform shul. No machitza, no anything. And the Reform rabbi digs up, or some of the members of the community dig up some matzahs and some gefilte fish, and this is what he eats. But he tells the people, I'm afraid I can't daven you, even though it's Rosh Hashanah, there's no machitza. And the people are very taken by his words, and they separate themselves, even though in that informal machitza, so he really couldn't daven, but he showed his appreciation of their effort. And during his time there on Rosh Hashanah, he began teaching, giving classes. And as we would expect the story to end, there were a number of individuals, young people, who were at that in that community at that time, who were so taken by his words, they went to Or Sameach, and now are living happily ever after as firm observant Jews. If you would have asked that rabbi, did he want to land up in Bangkok during Rosh Hashanah instead of Eretz Yisrael, the answer would be emphatically not. These are experiences where God chases us, where God has a different intention in mind than we had originally envisioned. And it's in these experiences that we're here to pick up the spark, to take advantage of these situations. And I think on a final note, Yaakov Avinu returning back home, when he meets these angels, as Source 53, Yaakov went on his way and the angels of God encountered him. Yaakov said when he saw them, this is a godly camp, so he called the name of the place Machanaim, a double camp. Explains Rav Nissen Alpert Zichron HaLevracha Limudei Nissan, why is it called Machanaim? Because when Yaakov Avinu came home, right before he went into Israel, he looked back over the last 20 years and asked himself, have I been as an honest person as I should have? Did I deal in the most proper way as I should have? He looked at all of his actions and basically asked himself, has he redeemed those sparks? Has he elevated the situation and behaved in the proper way? And when he realized in the affirmative that he had, so then he realized that his physical actions were really spiritual ones, and that the physical actions really created spiritual energies. And that's the Machanayim, the double angels, where the physical actions, the sparks that they created, were really spiritual sparks. And I think that this is really the challenge that we have. Different periods in our lives. Here is Yaakov Avinu returning from Galus. It could be at the end of a day, it could be every Shabbos, it could be every month on Rosh Chodesh. We have different times in our lives that we have to stop. We have to take a look at perspective to see a larger picture and ask ourselves, how are we doing in our spiritual endeavors? How are we doing in redeeming our sparks? Do we see a pattern within our life? Do we see we're going in the proper direction? Can we say about our lives, it's a machanaim, it's a double camp? And it's interesting that Sofin points out in the final source that before a person dies, God reveals himself to that person, where they see their entire lives in its entirety and the reasons why everything happens. That's the ultimate aspect we begin with of Vayetze, of the Yachdav, of seeing everything together. During our lives, we're often not afforded that opportunity to see the entire perspective. We don't have the ability to see the entire perspective. But as long as we have the ability to examine along the ways, perhaps not with an understanding of everything, that you need the whole perspective. But as long as we stop ourselves along the way, every night, every week on Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Hashanah, and we make sure that we're machanaim, we're on the path of spiritual goals, spiritual pursuits, that although we're down here on earth, Roshom, Magia, Shamaima, the Sulam is reaching upward, that we have this spiritual striving. We're looking for opportunities of spirituality, of redeeming these sparks, so then we know we're successful. We could take the model of Yaakov and loved ones' house as a model for our own lives and the loved ones and the charans that we undergo in our lives. Perhaps, in conclusion, this is the message of Ayetze. Why do we need to know all the details of Yaakov's sojourn in Haran? It's really to teach us a twofold lesson. It gives us the model and the paradigm of the Jew in Galus, and particularly the Jew with the Egyptian exile experience, that they came out unscathed and were able to maintain their identity, the transition from the fathers to the sons, as well as on an individual level, it's the ability for us as people to go through difficulties in life and come out on a higher spiritual plateau. And the model of Lavan chasing after Yaakov is the model of the pressure we have of the society around us. Sigar saduta, melt in, become one large melting pot, or one large salad bowl. We need to maintain our identity, maintain our language, maintain what makes us distinct. And on a deeper level, on the level of remes, Lavan chasing after Yaakov are the experiences in life where we don't anticipate. We oversleep a flight, whatever it may be. We have these opportunities in life to take a look at them as challenges of redeeming the sparks, elevating it, and coming closer to God.